Hi, I'm James McIlvenny, and you're listening to the History and Philosophy of the Language Sciences podcast, online at hifilangsci.net. There you can find links and references to all the literature we discuss. In the previous episode, we observed how, by the middle of the 19th century, comparative historical linguistics had expanded to deal with most of the branches of the Indo-European family tree, and how the same methods were being applied to reconstruct other language families from around the world. We then looked in detail at the philosophy of science elaborated by August Schleicher, the chief consolidator of comparative historical linguistics in this period. He maintained a materialist or monist philosophy, which sought to assimilate linguistics to the natural sciences, and which was accompanied by an extreme scientific realism. If we cast our minds further back in the podcast series to episode 3, we'll recall that in the beginning, comparative historical linguistics was closely intertwined with efforts at language classification, essentially the forerunner to present-day work in typology. But as comparative historical linguistics developed over the course of the 19th century, it became increasingly decoupled from language classification. However, in the middle of the century, the link between these two sides was still not entirely broken. In his efforts to develop a morphology of language, Schleicher very much continued the tradition of language classification. In this episode, we look at Schleicher's morphology and compare it to its intellectual foil, the language classification put forward by Steinthal within the framework of Völkerpsychologie, or psychology of peoples. In present-day linguistics, morphology is a generic technical term that's basically used to describe all the processes in languages that take place at the level of words. That is, such processes as compounding, affixation, inflection, and so on. But around the beginning of the 19th century, morphology was a neologism associated above all with the biological writings of the great German poet and polymath Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Goethe's morphology was a theory of the development of biological organisms, both in terms of the development of individuals over their own lifetime, that is, ontogenesis, and the evolution of species over time, that is, phylogenesis. Goethe's theory has many points in common with the contributions to comparative anatomy of such figures as Johann Friedrich Blumenbach and Georges Cuvier, which we discussed in the first episode. Goethe worked out his theory of morphology over several decades, but the central publication in which he laid it out is the work Zur Morphologie, On Morphology, which Goethe published in 6 parts from 1817 to 1824. The title of the essay in which Schleicher introduced his own theory of linguistic morphology clearly echoes the title of Goethe's work. Schleicher's essay was called Zur Morphologie der Sprache, On the Morphology of Language. The fundamental aim of Goethe's morphology is to identify the archetypal forms underlying each organism on both the individual ontogenetic level and the species-wide phylogenetic level. The phylogenetic aspect of Goethe's theory is perhaps the most comprehensible from our present-day perspective. By comparing the structures of plants and animals, Goethe hoped to identify their commonalities and through this process abstract away their differences to discover the Urpflanze, or protoplant, and the Urtier, or protoanimal. That is, Goethe believed he could find the essential or archetypal forms underlying all plants and animals. This concept of Urpflanze, or Urtier, may be congenial to us because it has points of contact with present-day ideas about evolution. The Urpflanze, or Urtier, can be understood as the common ancestor from which the plants and creatures that we encounter in the world have descended. In fact, Charles Darwin, in a brief historical sketch of his predecessors that he added to the third edition of his On the Origin of Species, supported such an interpretation of Goethe's theory. On the ontogenetic level, Goethe imagined that there's an underlying archetype for each part of a living thing, which then grows into all of its diversified organs. So there's supposedly an archetypal leaf that grows into all the parts of a plant, the stem, the leaves, the petals of a flower, its stamens, and so on. In the animal world, there's an archetypal bone that unifies all the parts of the skeleton. Goethe believed that this bone is the vertebra. One feature of Goethe's theory that's rather different from our present-day conceptions, however, is that he imagined the growth of organisms to be a teleological or goal-directed process, motivated and guided by the Bildungstrieb, or the drive to formation. This notion of Bildungstrieb is something that Goethe adopted from Blumenbach. Needless to say, the Bildungstrieb is one of these mysterious forces of Naturphilosophy that were targeted by the materialists of the 19th century, who we met in the previous episode. As we'll recall, the materialists felt that such forces were superfluous and belonged more in the realm of superstition than science. But there were many who sought to bridge the gap to retain the insights of the earlier biological scholarship while making it compatible with the metaphysics of modern science. One of the most prominent of these figures was Ernst Haeckel, Schleicher's friend and intellectual ally in Jena. In his 1866 Generelle Morphologie, or General Morphology, Haeckel developed a theory combining Goethe's insights on ontogenesis and phylogenesis with the new path-breaking Darwinian theory. Haeckel, citing Schleicher as one of his sources of inspiration, had his cake and ate it too. He allowed that there is indeed a directed process of growth in individual organisms, and a direction in species evolution, but these were not the product of a mysterious non-material force, but rather the outcome of recognizable mechanical forces interacting with each other. For example, the increasing fitness of organisms to their environment that appears to occur in evolution comes about through the processes of variation within the population and natural selection, not through the intervention of the hand of God. Schleicher's linguistic morphology aimed to do for languages what Goethe's morphology, and later Haeckel's general morphology, did for the biological world. Schleicher's morphology sought to describe the building blocks and structures of all the world's languages, and, in addition, to fit those languages into an evolutionary framework. We must note, however, that Schleicher struck a very modern note in distinguishing between the typology of languages and their genealogical relatedness. In his morphology essay, Schleicher said that languages can belong to different morphological classes and still be related in a genealogical sense. But all in all, Schleicher continued the schemes of language classification that we talked about in episode 3. He sketched out his ideas most explicitly on this point in his 1860 Die Deutsche Sprache, a comparative historical representation of the German language within the context of the Indo-European family. Schleicher believed that the different language types, isolating, agglutinative, and inflectional, represented different stages of language evolution. The most primitive state of language, according to Schleicher, is isolation, where word roots are undifferentiated. Agglutinative structures then supposedly emerge from isolation as linguistic forms differentiate to represent concepts through word roots and the relations between the word roots through affixes. Finally, inflection emerges from agglutination as the most developed linguistic form, where roots and inflections constitute integrated packages representing concepts and relations. Schleicher's typology and the links he makes between linguistic form and the supposed structure of thought, of course, represent a continuation of Wilhelm von Humboldt's discussion of grammatical processes, which we examined in episode 3. In an 1822 paper, On the Emergence of Grammatical Forms and Their Influence on the Development of Ideas, Humboldt endorsed the idea that there was a progression in the development of linguistic forms along the continuum isolating, agglutinative, inflectional. This view on the development of language became known as the agglutination theory and was supported by Franz Bopp in his Comparative Grammar in opposition to the absolute dichotomy between so-called organic and mechanical languages put forward by Friedrich Schlegel, which we also encountered in episode 3. Bopp used the agglutination theory to argue for a fluid relationship between different linguistic types. This fluidity allowed Bopp to postulate the analyses of verb conjugations as originally compounded forms, as we discussed in episode 2. Agglutination theory was rediscovered towards the end of the 20th century by practitioners of the new subfield of grammaticalization. Christian Lehmann, a major proponent of this approach, in his 1982 Thoughts on Grammaticalization, saw in agglutination theory a precursor of his own ideas. Schleicher also followed Humboldt in assuming that the development of language through these stages occurred in the prehistoric period and ceased in the historical period. Where Schleicher went beyond Humboldt, however, was to assume that languages go into decline as soon as their speakers enter the historical period. This explains the development of the modern analytic languages from their synthetic predecessors, which had been observed by August Wilhelm Schlegel, and which we also discussed in episode 3. The degree of decline of a language, according to Schleicher, is directly proportional to the involvement of its speakers in world history. For example, English is the most degenerate of the Germanic languages, having lost almost all of its inflectional morphology and having virtually sunk back to the level of an isolating language like Chinese. The reason for this degeneracy is that the English as a nation are so deeply involved in international affairs. In his morphology, Schleicher focused exclusively on the outer phonetic form of words, as he put it. This is in contrast to the inner form. Like many linguistic ideas in this period, the distinction between outer and inner form goes back to Wilhelm von Humboldt, in particular to a passage in his work on the Kavi language. Humboldt's use of the term inner form is rather brief and offhand, but it would seem that what he had in mind was some sort of notion of the internal structure of a language at a level deeper than the immediately visible surface forms. Schleicher's painstakingly empirical philosophy of science held him back from attempting to capture the inner form of languages. Schleicher argued that to do so would be inevitably speculative given the current state of knowledge, although he did allow the possibility that later advances may make inner form amenable to scientific investigation. In contrast to Schleicher, Steintal did attempt to penetrate to the level of inner form. Steintal took this notion from Humboldt and developed it into the cornerstone of his own mid-19th century scheme of language classification. At this point, we should briefly observe that Steintal is usually referred to as Heimann Steintal, although in the literature and in some library catalogues, he's also to be found under the names Heinemann and even Hermann and Heinrich. Steintal notes himself, in autobiographical notes he later wrote, that his name was never officially recorded because he was Jewish, and at the time of his birth in Prussia, Jewish members of the community were barred from inclusion in the register of births, deaths, and marriages. For this reason, no single official version of his name was recorded. Steintal's own practice was to simply use his initial, H. Within the Jewish community, Steintal used the name Chaim. Steintal was known primarily as one of the most prominent interpreters of Humboldt in the 19th century, and for the theory of Völkerpsychologie, which he developed in collaboration with his colleague and friend, indeed his brother-in-law, Moritz Lazarus. Völkerpsychologie, literally psychology of peoples, was an attempt to create an all-encompassing theory of society and culture which touched on topics that today would be considered to belong to such diverse fields as anthropology, history, philology, and linguistics. The study of language was always a core component of Völkerpsychologie. In fact, the journal that Lazarus and Steintal founded in 1859 as the primary organ for the new discipline was called the Zeitschrift für Völkerpsychologie und Sprachwissenschaft, the Journal for Völkerpsychologie and Linguistics. The central concern of Völkerpsychologie was to study the Volksgeist, the spirit of the people, a term that we already encountered in episode 2 when we discussed the Grimm's historicism. Lazarus and Steintal's proposal was to take the methods of scientific individual psychology, which was well established in several different traditions at the time, and apply these to study the shared mentality of entire peoples. A Volk, or people, they argued, is a voluntary and culturally defined entity. That is, anyone who believes themselves to belong to a particular people and partakes of its culture is a member of that people. Lazarus and Steintal's view of the Volk is in contrast to the racialist approaches of such figures as Schleicher. Whereas Schleicher tried to reduce each people to its biology, the physical properties of their bodies and brains, Lazarus and Steintal looked to the minds of the people. Lazarus and Steinthal's approach accorded well with their political views. Both were part of a movement among 19th century Jewish Germans who considered themselves to be first and foremost members of the German nation, but at the same time wanted to maintain their distinct Jewish identity within it. Their voluntarist notion of a people, where membership in a nation is determined by participation in its culture, provides a mechanism for constructing such an identity. Needless to say, Lazarus and Steinthal's views were attacked by anti-Semites of the time who sought to erect essentialist racial definitions of Germanness and Jewishness. But they were also attacked by some people of Jewish background who believed that Jewish people should simply assimilate to the Christian majority in Germany. Even though Prussia in their day was at a relatively liberal point in its history, both Lazarus and Steinthal suffered from discrimination, more or less overt. The instability of Steinthal's given name is just one example of this discrimination. Another is the fact that both Lazarus and Steinthal hit the glass ceiling. Despite their intellectual prominence and the widespread reception of their ideas, neither reached the rank of ordinary professor in Berlin. Like so many other language scholars in this period, Lazarus and Steinthal played up the political dimension of their work. In addition to legitimizing the place of the Jewish minority in the German nation, Lazarus and Steinthal also advertised Völkerpsychologie as a means to cultivating the German Volksgeist, as a preliminary to achieving political unification in the turbulent period of the mid-19th century. According to Lazarus and Steinthal, language is one of the main expressions of the Volksgeist. This idea led Steinthal, in his linguistic writings, to try to capture and characterize languages by laying bare their respective inner forms. For Steinthal, there's a sense in which all of language is form and nothing else. That is, language is simply a representation of thoughts, in the same way that a stage play is a representation of some event that might happen in the real world, or a portrait is a representation of a person. But, according to Steinthal, there's still a sense in which a language can make a more or less pure representation of thoughts, and this is how we identify inner form. There are material parts of language that represent the conceptual elements of thought, and then more purely formal parts that represent the relations between the concepts. So we see that Steinthal is simply continuing the distinction between conceptual and relational elements in language that we encountered in Humboldt's work, and also in Schleicher's work. The difference between Steinthal and Schleicher, however, is that Steinthal doesn't link the conceptual and the formal elements to directly visible parts of language. That is, Steinthal doesn't assume that an isolating language is necessarily devoid of relational elements, or that the grammatical affixes of an agglutinative language are necessarily purely formal. To be fair, we should perhaps briefly observe that Schleicher also hedges on this point, although in practice, he sticks to looking at outer form alone. So, on Steinthal's understanding, how do we penetrate to the level of inner form in a language? How do we decide if an element we observe is material or properly formal? Steinthal's answer is to say that we need to look to etymology. If a relation is expressed using material words, that is, words that also name concrete concepts, then the language doesn't have a properly developed inner form. An example that Steinthal uses is that if a language expressed the relation behind by saying something like A back B, then this is not properly formal. The etymological origin of the form back is still clear to speakers. It refers to a physical body part. Since the concrete conceptual origin is still apparent, this is a material word being used to represent a formal relation. The kind of analysis that Steinthal is making here is unfortunately rather slippery. Whether an etymology can be established for a relational element in a language is largely a question of the ingenuity of the linguist. It also doesn't really tell us much about the psychological reality of the etymologies for speakers of the language. That is, even if a linguist can construct an etymology, it doesn't mean that speakers of the language are conscious of this etymology when they use the word. These are some of the criticisms that were leveled at Steinthal by his contemporaries. Steinthal makes the presence or absence of inner form the core parameter in his language classification. This feature cross-cuts the traditional morphological classification. In his 1860 Characterization of the Main Types of Language Construction, Steintal sets up two main categories, Formsprachen, that is, languages with inner form, and formlose Sprachen, languages without inner form. Steintal classifies the isolating language Chinese as a Formsprache. His argument is that Chinese has a highly developed syntax and a large range of purely formal grammatical particles. These properties mean that the language has properly developed inner form, even though this inner form is not manifested in the classical morphological categories of inflection or affixes. But other isolating languages that superficially seem to have a similar grammatical structure to Chinese, such as many languages of Southeast Asia, are not considered by Steintal to have properly developed inner form. He was unable to identify in these languages the pure particles and syntactic structures that he found in Chinese. And the incorporating languages of the Americas were also classified by Steintal as lacking inner form, because all the grammatical elements allegedly have a clear material origin. The slipperiness of Steintal's classification is on show here. Why could he see inner form in Chinese, but not in structurally similar Southeast Asian languages? And why is there no inner form in American languages, despite their elaborate morphology? Could it be that Steintal's analyses are influenced by preconceived ideas about which peoples should be considered civilized? Even though Steintal wanted to avoid the reductionist materialist philosophy that characterized Schleicher's work, we can see in Steintal's choice of terms that he was not averse to pursuing biological analogies. His terms Formsprachen and formlose Sprachen are directly parallel to Wirbeltiere and wirbellose Tiere, the existing German terms for vertebrates and invertebrates. He is therefore seeking to build a parallel between his classification of languages and the taxonomic classification of animals. In the coming episodes, we'll explore critiques of Schleicher's and Steintal's views and look at the new theoretical positions that emerge from them. But first, in the next episode, we'll take a look at some of the sources European linguists in this period had available for their typological work by discussing with Clara Stockett the state of language documentation in Australia in the 19th century.